Greetings, everyone, and welcome to The Law Hour, an editorial review. The Law Hour is sponsored by Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour, an editorial review, is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries around the world over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please visit our webpage. That's georgegordon.org. Again, georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and editorial review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on cross-examination when we come back. Well, those who already walk submissively will say that there is no cause for alarm. But submissiveness is not our heritage. The First Amendment was designed to allow rebellion to remain as our heritage, and the Constitution was designed to keep government off the backs of the people, and the Bill of Rights was added to keep the precincts of belief and expression of the press of political and social activities free from government surveillance. Ah, you say the words of a radical, an anti-government, a lawless individual. No, I wished I'd have thought of that myself, but that quotation comes from Supreme Court Justice William O. Douglas. Now, our princes, our politicians, beller in the halls of our Congress for more taxes, more spending, and more gun control, but you and I haven't heard anything intelligent come out of a politician's mouth in more than 75 years. And that's why I contend that the only real reason, logic, or common sense left in America comes from our courts, not from our political process. It certainly doesn't come from our politicians, our lawyers, or our bureaucrats. Now, old Mayor Rothschild summed it up with a flair when he said, "You give me the money power, and I care not who makes the laws." Well, let me echo that point by saying, you give me the judicial power and I care not who makes the laws either, because the real power in America is in our courts, not in our politics. Now, if you'd like to tap into that power of the courts, why don't you call us here at the law school? The number is 417-273-4967, and be sure to ask for our free general law CD package. Now, that's a 4-hour commentary. It's a commentary on the law school, but it's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative, and best of all, it's free of charge. Now, Courtroom Strategy and Procedure, the school, is available on compact disc for adult home education. Now, if you're online, go to our website. It's georgegordon.org. Click on to the email and send an email request for your free general law CD package. Remember, georgegordon.org, or call direct, 417-273-4967. All right, last time we took up the subject of cross-examination. I said that there are 23 techniques that we use in cross-examination. I showed you humor last time. The 23 are, we use humor, we use details to impeach the testimony of an adverse witness, we may rely upon collateral matters or memory, or an expose, or a demonstration. We may flatter the witness or use confrontation. Maybe memorization or contradictions and inconsistencies in testimony. Explanation and embarrassment. We use tests. We use hypotheticals. We tap into overconfidence. And we use many witnesses. We have what we call the trump card, the high point, silent cross, and eyewitnesses to impeach testimony of liars. We use the power of suggestion and friendly, impartial inquiry and partisanship to trip up our adverse witnesses. Now, remember last time I said that the best thing that can happen to you is that your opponents lie about you. You know, most people would say, well, that's the worst thing that could happen. They're lying about me. No, that's the best thing. The worst thing that can happen to you is that your opponent tells the truth about you. There's no defense against the truth. That'll lay you away every time. But if they're lying about you, I can uncover those lies, and so can you. And you can show the judge and the jury that that guy that's on the witness stand is lying by having him contradict himself out of his own mouth. There's a biblical quotation. King David used it against a guy one time. He said, "Out of your own mouth have you condemned yourself." Which leads us to this conclusion, and that is all of the evidence that's ever going to be used against you is going to be furnished by you. Remember, when you rob a bank and you run out of the bank with a bag of cash, and three witnesses on the sidewalk later come into court and point at you sitting at the defense table and say, "That's the guy that we saw running out of the bank." When the bank teller points her finger at you and says, "That's the guy that put the gun in my face and robbed me." And when they play the surveillance tape and your picture is on the surveillance tape with the gun pointed at the teller over there, all of that evidence was created by you. Nobody else. Now, if you're not the guy that's on the videotape surveillance, you weren't at the bank, and you're innocent, and these people are pointing the finger and saying, "Hey, that's the guy over there that did it," then it's time for you to get on the witness stand, number one, and deny it, and create the contested issue of fact. You know, most of the criminal convictions that come down in the absence of any testimony from the defendant himself, which, after all, is good thinking on the part of defense attorneys, because 85% of their clients are, in fact, guilty. But of the 15% that are innocent, failure to deny the allegations that are being made against you are fatal. Well, they're fatal 94% of the time, because that's the number of times that you'll go into court out of 100 and lose your case. 94% of criminal defendants lose. So if you want to win a criminal case, then you've got to do something different than the average ordinary Joe Sixpack. Well, at least the ordinary Joe Sixpacks that lose 94% of the time. And after all, we're not here to exonerate or to help guilty defendants beat the rap. We're here to help those 15% that are innocent and are being caught up and convicted of crimes that they didn't commit. So let's learn how to do that. One of the techniques that we learn in cross-examination is called pay attention to details. Pay attention to the details. Now listen to this story. J.W. Donovan, the author of Modern Jury Trials, quotes the Brooklyn Eagle's account of a trial conducted by Charles Spencer against the late Edwin James as opposing counsel involving a soldier's claim for $1,800, money loaned to a friend after the Civil War. The defendant's counsel, Mr. James, cross-examining the plaintiff, asked, question, "You loaned him $1,800? Answer, "I did, sir." Question, "When, sir?" Answer, "In 1866. Question, "Where did you get it?" Answer, "I earned it, sir." Very meekly. Question, "When did you earn it?" Answer, "During the war, sir." Very meekly. And question, "What was your occupation during the war?" Answer, very modestly, "Fighting, sir." Now, up to this time, the issue had been much in doubt, but now the jury plainly leaned to the side of the soldier. Colonel Spencer, sensing this, closed the evidence as quickly as possible, and he summed up to the jury about the soldier who guarded our liberties, helped to save our nation, risked his life, and he won the verdict. Commenting upon the case later that day, Mr. James said to Colonel Spencer, "Well, that war speech of yours did it, and it was all the fault of my cross-examination. Otherwise, you would have known nothing about his war record." "Ah," said Colonel Spencer, "the mistake that you made was that you didn't find out that my client was a Confederate soldier, or you could have changed the whole verdict yourself." Now, that's the power of details. The cross-examiner opened the subject matter, but he didn't go far enough into the details. The devil is in the details. Had he asked, "Who were you fighting for?" "I was fighting for the Confederate Army. The case is being tried in New York City." Not very likely that a New York jury, a jury of Yankees, is going to give a Confederate soldier any compensation. Here again, one of the techniques that we use falls into one of those 23 categories that we use to find out the answer to our question. Now, in this case, we presume that the guy did in fact loan him the money, and in fact he had the money coming to him. Whether he was a Confederate or not is irrelevant and immaterial. He loaned him the money. Did he pay it back? The guy says, no, he didn't pay him back. This takes us to a subject matter called collateral matters. And after all, his military record was a collateral matter to the central subject of, do you or do you not owe this guy the money? Did you or did you not lend him the money? Did he or did he not pay you back? Here's an example of collateral matters. When we deal with the subject of collateral matters, we're talking about whether or not this guy has, or whether or not we're staying on point, or whether or not the subject matter at hand has been covered. Now, in the O.J. Simpson trial, the subject, Mark Furman, was testifying about O.J. Simpson and said that Simpson was a murderer, and his point was that he wanted to show that Simpson had killed his wife, and his point was that there was evidence, and he was on the stand as a detective to testify against O.J. Simpson. And F. Lee Bailey, who has been called the greatest cross-examiner, well, since, I guess, Francis Wellman back in 1902, put Furman on the stand and asked him a series of questions for about 3 hours. And I watched that cross-examination and I said, why, he never laid a glove on Furman. Here's the greatest cross-examiner in history, or at least in modern times, and he never laid a glove on that guy. I was disappointed, quite frankly. A week later, Bailey brought Furman back, put him on the stand, and asked him essentially the same questions. And this time, remember, it was over the N-word, and he tripped him up on this nigger and N-word, and do you use the N-word? Do you remember that famous N-word? Well, Furman had denied that he'd ever used the N-word, and right away when somebody says to me they never used the N-word, I know the guy's lying right there. We all do. We all listen to jokes. We all hear it, and we all use it from time to time. So when somebody says he never uses the N-word, you can just about bet the guy's lying to you. Oh, he wants to be politically correct and well thought of, but he's not telling the truth. And as it came out, this guy Furman, when he was asked, have you ever used the N-word in the last 10 years? Well, 7 years prior to that, he made a videotape. Do you remember that? And in that videotape, he was using the nigger word over and over again. Well, wait a minute. Are we here talking about race relations in the O.J. Simpson case? No. We're talking about murder. That's the subject matter. But Furman was taken out on collateral matters. Now, here's a classic example of this collateral matter and the way you use it. Henry E. Lazarus, he was a prominent merchant in the city. That was New York City. He was indicted a few years ago by the federal grand jury, charged with the offense of bribing a United States officer and violation of the Sabotage Act. Lazarus was honorably acquitted by a jury after a 30-minute deliberation. It was during the height of the war, and Mr. Lazarus was a very large manufacturer of rubber coats and had manufactured hundreds of thousands of these rubber coats for the government under contract. Now, the government, for its protection, employed large numbers of inspectors, and in the heat and excitement of war, These inspectors occasionally tried to make good, as the term was used, and one of these efforts resulted in the indictment of Lazarus. The chief witness against Lazarus was Charles L. Fuller. Fuller was the supervising inspector attached to the depot quartermaster's office in New York City. Fuller testified that Lazarus gave money to him to influence him in regard to his general duties as an inspector, and to overlook the fact that Lazarus was manufacturing defective coats and thereby violating the Sabotage Act. Well, Martin W. Littleton acted as chief counsel for the defense and was fully appreciative of Mr. Lazarus's high character and his conscientious discharge of his duties in the manufacture of material for the government. He was also well informed as to the general character and the history of the government's chief witness, Mr. Fuller. So after Fuller had completed his testimony in chief, he was first questioned closely as to the time when he became an employee of the government. Now, counsel, knowing that he was required to make and sign and then to swear to an application as to his prior experience. Now, a messenger had been sent to the government files to get the original of this application, signed by the witness, and he came into court with the document in his hand just as counsel was putting the following question to Fuller. The first question was, "Did you sign such an application?" Fuller answered, "I did, sir." And the next question was, "Well, did you swear to it?" Answer, "No, I did not swear to it." Question, "I show you your name signed on the bottom of this blank and ask you if you signed that application for employment with the United States government." Answer, "Yes, sir, I did." Question, "Do you see the word sworn to?" Answer, "I had forgotten it." "You see, there is a seal on it." "Well, I had forgotten that also." Question, "This application appears to be subscribed to on the 24th day of May 1918 by Charles Lawrence Fuller." Answer, "It must be right if I have sworn to it on that date." Question, "Well, do you remember in May of 1918 that you signed and that you swore to this application?" Answer, "That is so. I must